Good afternoon to our Inspire Answers Radio listeners. Today we're honored to speak with a true visionary who's making an extraordinary difference in the lives of young women across South Africa. Your post is really needed and appreciated and valued. You are the passionate founder behind 1828, an organization dedicated to empowering and uplifting young women through education and mentorship. So if everyone can just give a warm welcome to Refilwe Sisiyane. Give us a brief history about who you are and then how you came to found 1828.
With pleasure, Ilham. So firstly, hello to you and to your listeners. It's really a pleasure for us to be here on Inspire LC's Radio, and talking about 1828 is one of my favorite things to do. So if you feel I'm getting a little bit carried away, just rein me in. We started the organization 14 years ago. And really the inspiration behind it was to empower girls and young women between the ages of 18 and 28, which is why we're called 1828. The main objective for us is to make sure that they access higher education. We want to see the girls and young women using access to higher education as a tool for their personal empowerment and their personal development. What happens is a lot of the communities in which we work are characterized by a lack of role models and academic mentors. And so girls really struggle to find someone to look up to, someone who will inspire them, someone who will guide them in terms of that transition, coming out of grade 12 at the age of 18, and really stepping into the big wide world, getting into college, into varsity, without a sense of confidence, without a sense of knowing what lies next. We go into schools in terms of our programs. Let me just give you a breakdown. The first initiative that we have is an intervention for girls in grade 11 and grade 12. And what we do is we go to marginalized high schools, interacting with the school principal as well as the head of life orientation for grade 11 and 12. And we see where the girls are in the LO curriculum. And that is how we design content and workshops that aligns with the LO curriculum and really just to augment the girls' learning with the objective of opening up their minds, getting them to start thinking about what they're going to do post grade 12. So are you attending university open days? Are you attending campus visits? Are you getting a sense of what sort of degree streams you can follow? Which colleges are offering the courses that you want to study? Have you submitted your applications on time? We're seeing increasingly a lot of girls who wait until they've got their end of year results from a trick before they start submitting their applications. And by then it's too late because you've got hundreds and thousands of other matriculants all waiting in line wanting to get accepted into university. We want to encourage them to start thinking from the end of grade 11, basically. By the end of grade 11, you're submitting your application, you've got your school report, you've got your results, and you're reaching out to more than one university for your studies. We then move across to when the girls are already accepted into their tertiary institutions of choice. So we work only with accredited higher education institutions, Ilham. And I think on that note, before I elaborate more on our programs, we have a problem in our country in terms of these fly-by-night schools and fly-by-night colleges, where you think you are enrolling for a credible program, and by the time you've done 3 or 4 years of your diploma or your certificate or course, it's basically not even worth the piece of paper that is printed on. So we're quite specific to make sure that you are at an accredited higher education institution to avoid wasting time, wasting money, energy, and effort at these fly-by-night institutions. So the high school workshops are the only intervention that we have at high school level. The rest of our programs focus on girls at higher education level, whether it's your college, your varsity, your university of technology, and we want them to pursue any course of their choice, any study discipline that they're passionate about, because our vision is all about a South Africa in which girls and young women are educated and empowered to lead. So for us, it's not about prescribing what you should study. In this country, there tends to be a lot of preference given to girls in STEM careers. There's a lot of bursaries around STEM, so your science, technology, education, and mathematics. Whereas we think if we're going to grow this economy, we need to have young professionals, passionate young people who are really excited to do the work that they're doing across all sectors, so not only focusing on STEM. And that's why on our website, you'll see over the years, we've worked with girls across disciplines. So we've got young lawyers, we've got graphic designers, we've got girls who did hairdressing. We're really across the board, and we want them to do something that they're passionate about, as opposed to, well, I'm studying this because that's the only bursary that I could find. So with that financial assistance program, we would be fundraising locally and internationally to pay for tuition fees, laptops, textbooks, stationery, and accommodation for any undergraduate or postgraduate degree of the girl's choice. We then have a mentorship program called the Big Sister Network, and that essentially matches them up to a woman that they can look up to and draw inspiration from in terms of their academic journey. And then finally, our fourth program is a leadership development camp, where we bring all the girls together across the different university campuses across South Africa, where we have a leadership weekend and we really hone in on leadership as a topic. For us, leadership is not about title. If you are a young woman and you are seeing an issue that's affecting you at home domestically, it's affecting you in terms of your immediate community, it's affecting you even on campus, at high school, you need to speak up. You need to address that issue because you have agency. The very fact that this is something that is impacting you and potentially impacting your friends or another young woman, any of your sisters, means that you have that agency to speak up. It's not about title. It's not about the fact that you are head girl at school or a prefect at school, or you are on the dean's list at your varsity, or you are now head of SRC at your varsity. Speak up about all of these issues in the home, in the community, on campus, at high school, because that is how we breed active citizenship and make sure that we are empowering women with the voice and the agency that they already have to address a lot of these issues in our country. So, yes, I know it was a big nutshell because you know I love to talk about 1828, but it's the high school workshops, it's the financial assistance program, it's the Big Sister Network, which is our mentorship program, and then it is the leadership camp, which is the weekend experience for girls at different varsities across the country.
Yeah, that was a everything in one.
Big mouthful.
Okay, so it's Women's Day next week on the 9th of August. And I feel like what you had to say is really vital in growing your network because there is a big inequality in women's positions in society, especially in South African society, because we come from a very patriarchal society. So, as much as we're building and we're learning and we're educating and we always kind of being told, maybe not also directly, but we feel like we always have to be subservient or under somebody. And like to have a network where you're talking about speak up, it is very important that we have our voices and we have people that we can trust and listen to us. So let's get into the content. So we're talking about financial literacy. We're also talking about the pay gap. Then we're talking about GBV. And I think the most important part is lack of representation and leadership in spheres in our society that decision making takes place. Because I feel like, say you're in a boardroom and there's decisions being made, and you maybe have a voice, but your input isn't always being taken in or maybe listened to. And then also healthcare, and then traditional cultures. So, when it comes to financial literacy, in South Africa, we have a high number of female-headed households, and women's common employment in informal sectors is in South Africa in the informal sector. So a lot of women don't work in offices. They work selling things in tuck shops, or they start a business, or they work in a clothing store. So what specific cultural sensitive and accessible financial literacy programs are most effective in empowering young women and even older women just to manage their finances, build assets, overcome systematic barriers, and to be included in the financial world, especially in rural areas and like far out of the city areas? What is your take on that?
I think in answering that question, Ilham, I want to speak about the so-called unbanked women of society and the unbanked women in our country. I think it's a bit of a misnomer to say that they're unbanked because they are very much active participants in terms of our financial sector, in terms of the economic growth of the country. I'm going to go back to an example that I often want to include in terms of when we discuss financial literacy, women building up assets, women using debt responsibly, and women empowering other women financially. And the example that I want to share is simply stokvel, okanye nesiXhosa umgalelo, where a group of us are each contributing the same amount of money each month, and we're putting in the same amount in the pot. and it gets distributed in a lump sum to one member, and we go around the circle in a group until each person has had their share. That system of Stockvel not only is around inclusivity, financial inclusivity, it's also around inclusivity in the sense that women fully understand the issues that they themselves are facing, but also that they are facing one another as a collective. And so you know that the woman next door has to take her child to school, or the woman next door needs a specific sewing machine to get up her sewing business up and running, her tailoring business or dressmaking business up and running. And the money that she's collecting from the Stockvel is precisely that which helps her get that asset to grow her business. Now, why it is also inclusive is because it's centered around trust, and self-disclosure also builds trust. So if you are able to be vulnerable with the members of your Stockvel to say, when the turn comes around to me and I get my share of the pot, I am going to build an extra room and get another tenant in my back room to generate an income. And what we found is that the women who are using the money from Stockvels are not necessarily only spending that money on living expenses, on things like groceries, rent, food, airtime, electricity. They're actually channeling that money towards capital assets. So when I mentioned things like sewing machines, potentially even motor vehicles and cars to start a transport business, I also mentioned the idea of the sewing machine for dressmaking business. All of those assets are capital in nature. And that is then used to generate further income. So when you start thinking around, well, how that money is used, necessarily some of them will be having to interact with the banks for their businesses because they have to have a place where they're putting in their profits and their earnings from the businesses. And so this notion of being unbanked, I think for me, is fundamentally changing when we start using things like cell phones, especially in rural areas. It doesn't have to be a smartphone. It can be a normal phone where you are accessing your bank through a normal USSD, which is the *120 star numbers, and you are still able to transact and interact to send money to women who are not in geographic proximity to you, but who nonetheless can still use the money. So let's start thinking differently in terms of our financial literacy and start making sure that we are tapping into our own assets, meaning our own knowledge systems, meaning the knowledge that we are gaining from the women within our immediate groups, our church groups, our temples, the places of worship. Also, the schooling communities are big, big places where we can share and inspire one another and gain that knowledge that we need. But I wanted to focus specifically on Stockvels because it's been a major source of financial empowerment for women in this country.
That is so true, Rifilwe. We're going now into the gender pay gap, which I'm sure you can relate to. Gender pay gap is a big issue for me because if we of different sex and we can do exactly the same thing, why do I get paid less? So considering that the significant portion of South Africa's gender pay gap is attributed to women, we suffer the most under this situation, especially in low-paying firms and sectors and industry. What tangible policy intervention and industry-specific strategies can effectively challenge and dismantle these deeply entrenched firm-level and sectorial biases to ensure equitable pay, career progression for women, and particularly Black women across all levels of employment?
So the issue around the gender pay gap for us, Ilham, is not just around the fact that we are getting less money for the same job as our male counterparts. It's also not around the fact that we are as qualified and experienced and have the same number of years in the sector and the industry as our male counterparts. It also fundamentally extends to pregnancy, maternity, and childcare. Because the longer a woman is away from her place of work, the less experience she's getting, the less number of years has in that sector to grow her CV and get enough networks to spread her skills into other sectors, potentially other companies, because she's away from the workplace and caring for children. And generally speaking, very few women are remunerated for caring for the children. And we're not saying that we don't have stay-at-home fathers or single dads who are also very much responsible in caring for their children, but the majority of child caregivers in this country are women, and there's a disproportionate weight that is placed on them from pregnancy to maternity to caring for the kids, where you are away from your place of work because of the children, and that care is unremunerated. So we need to start thinking, I think, from a policy perspective, in terms of what we're going to do for legislation around things like maternity leave, maternity pay, whether it is extended based on the number of children that women are having, or how much is going to be allocated by your company based on the time away that you are spending. Also, in a situation where the woman is not the sole provider, meaning that it isn't a female-headed household, which in this day and age is very rare, but to be able to negotiate with your partner from a position of equality in terms of how she can be financially compensated for the time that she's at home and being away from the children, because that is very much valuable work. If you think that you have to go back to work and have someone caring for your child, that nanny, that caregiver, your helper has to be paid for the work that she's doing domestically in your absence while you are at the workplace. And so, why are women then not being paid ordinarily to be doing that work? It's very important that we address that issue. There is a lot of research in terms of gender equality and bridging that gap, but fundamentally, I think the more females we have in positions of leadership at our big corporate companies, the listed companies, the more female-headed businesses that we have from an SMME level, the better it is going to be, because fundamentally they would understand the dynamics of what it means to be a working mother, what it means to be a young professional, even for women who don't have children, to really help to bridge that gap in gender pay and to make sure that we are adequately remunerated for our skills, for our time, and for our qualifications.
I think we also need to really put it in legislation. There isn't a law that says also in companies there's to be like 50% representation of women. So the fact that numbers have been declining over the years, now over the past 5 years, that women are now less represented in boardrooms, for example, even in parliament, is becoming a major problem because we make the babies. We make the
So,
nation.
oh yes, absolutely. And we know the link between economic growth and national GDP and fertility. We've got countries that have got aging fertility that is really problematic in terms of what happens for the growth of those economies, because if you don't have enough people being born and enough people being economically active, how do you grow your GDP and make your country profitable and successful? I think what I wanted to mention was just to touch quickly on BEE, where there is an element of the scorecard that is specific around Black women ownership, Black women management, female representation at BEE level. But again, that's something that's purely voluntary, and people do it in terms of good governance and in terms of being good corporate citizens. There's nothing that compels companies to have X number of women, but you are certainly looked upon favorably if you have a better BEE score. And the way to do that is to have more women in management positions, in leadership positions, in ownership positions within those companies. And so that could possibly be a very good way to leverage BEE to make sure that it's used as a very direct way of addressing gender inequality and making sure that we have competent women leading our companies, competent women managing companies and owning companies.
And also just the support. I think everything is nice on paper, but if nobody's there to help you and you like you're not maybe academically inclined, then it is a difficult road to walk. So I think we need to have more support in all structures, especially for Black women and women of color. So GBV is a major issue in South Africa. How do specific traditional and cultural practices in South Africa, and this applies to us also, like in the Muslim society also, such as certain interpretations of Lobola, and we have also very strong patriarchal norms and the societal expectations of female subserviency contribute to the normalization of GBV? And what do you think collaborative community-led initiatives are proving most successful in transforming these harmful norms?
So the answer to that question, I think, for us is twofold, Ilham. We have the issue of gender-based violence, yes, and we fully appreciate that the majority of the time it would be men who are perpetrators of GBV. But why I'm saying I'm wearing two hats in terms of this response is that we cannot overlook the fact that men themselves have witnessed and experienced gender-based violence. And we cannot overlook the fact that there are issues of boys and young men being kidnapped, being sodomized, being abused sexually, physically, emotionally. We also can't overlook how they are impacted by witnessing gender-based violence. So a young man will say, I've seen my father or my stepfather or my uncle or a male figure physically or mentally abusing my mother or my sister's boyfriend is abusive towards her. And that has an impact on you as a boy and a young man because you can't step up to someone who's physically stronger, who's aggressive, perhaps who's acting under the influence of an intoxicating substance like drugs or alcohol, because those people cannot be reasoned with. And how those boys then also become victims of GBV and are at the receiving end of it. It's very saddening to expect them to stand up to be champions of GBV and to address the issue of gender-based violence and to treat their classmates or their tertiary mates in a way that is respectful when we don't fully appreciate how they have been impacted by it. And for me, that doesn't take away the issue that majority of the people who are experiencing GBV are women and continue to be women, but overlooking the impact that this has had on men and how potentially that plays a role in how they act out in terms of how they have been impacted is something that's very important. So let's fully understand that we're never going to stop GBV fully if we keep seeing it as a women's only issue. Collaborative conversations and dialogue across the bridge, where we are sitting as groups of men, of women, as GBV groups, as community organizations, the police forum. We have to understand what we are doing as a collective and not seeing this as something that's only being done unto women. I've mentioned the issue of boys and young men similarly experiencing the same thing and how then they lash up when they become older and have issues in terms of their intimate partners' relationships and intimate partner violence becoming something that we see when things change and these young men grow up. That would be the first thing that I'm mentioning. The second thing is we also need to look at our own resources and look at how we can share and inspire other people. I'm bringing this up because there are a lot of organizations who are working with the survivors of rape, with survivors of physical assault, with survivors even of financial manipulation. There are people who are in transactional relationships who are doing certain things just to get money and how that is impacting them psychologically. When you are able to courageously and honestly share your experience, not only is it cathartic for you and you get a sense of healing and even closure, but your courage actually helps the next person who's had a similar experience to feel less of a sense of isolation and to feel less of a sense of shame. Because there is someone who can identify with what you have been through, and someone who will also. Important thing when we have these experiences that are extremely traumatic, when we go through moments of pain in life, is firstly to be courageous in our own times of pain and trauma, and to be empathetic and caring and kind towards those who have the same experience. And part of the reason that women are not going forward to report rape, to report assault and abuse. Is that often when they do so, they are not met with the level of empathy that they should be having as victims in that situation. And so you stay away from being examined by the district surgeon, you stay away from going to the police station, you stay away from going to a support group, even in your community, in your faith group, in your church, in your temple, at mosque, because there's a sense of shame and people are not going to take you seriously, or nothing is going to happen in terms even of the legal processes. And we are going to be perpetuating a problem that we need to see an end to. And as much as it is extremely difficult and painful, I think you need to take that first step and call that toll-free number, reach out to these organizations on WhatsApp, speak to someone online. It's completely confidential, and your case will be treated with the respect that it deserves. And those are the people who will then assist you with the legal processes, reporting to the police, and to help you to then share in a caring environment what happened to you and to hear from the stories of other survivors.
Rifu, we're running out of time, but I totally agree with you when it comes to sorting out the men of our country, because they are kind of the backbone of the country. And if you have a group of men that are unruly and abusive, and like you're saying, if they went through all these things, suffice to say, it's probably going to end up happening, them beating the women or them beating each other. So it really is a matter of sorting everybody out. It's not just, oh, help the woman. You need to help the men that are prone to violence so that it stops happening. I totally agree with you when it comes to that. If we can just keep our
Yeah.
answers a little bit more brief, because we only have 10 minutes left. When it comes to lack of representation and leadership for women, despite South Africa's progressive constitution, the words are nice. I just say everything on paper is nice, but relatively high political representation for women, it's very low. There's only one party that has a woman leader. What are the most persistent cultural, systematic, and workplace biases that continue to hinder women's meaningful ascension to retention of leadership positions in corporate boardrooms, senior management, trade unions, and what innovative approaches are needed to genuinely address this invisible struggle and foster inclusive leadership pipelines?
So we need to understand how we got to where we are. Because if we don't have that historical context and if we don't fully understand how we got to be where we are, we'll never be able to chart out a route and plan a map of progress to get us to where we need to be. And ours is a country, in fact, most countries where women really were second-class citizens for the longest time. And you could not do anything without the consent of your husband as a married woman, or your father, or even your son in some cases. You couldn't sign contracts in your own name. There are certain things that you just could not involve yourself in. Women didn't have the vote. And so that march of those women on the 9th of August in 1956 was really quite a catalytic moment for us because it was just time to stand up and make a change. Having said that, and again, you're going to think I'm playing devil's advocate. We need to be quite conscious of how misogynistic we as women can be, and how we also tend to disempower ourselves by perpetuating a lot of that misogyny and putting on a very patriarchal lens from which we view the world. Obviously, they say hurt people, and certain things that you have experienced, you're more likely to repeat. But I think, again, the answers lie within us as women and for the futures that we want to see for our children and for our daughters and for their children and future generations of women. When you speak around innovations, I've already spoken about how initiatives like our Leadership Camp and our Big Sister Network are really active platforms for intergenerational dialogue, for intergenerational inspiration, mentorship, and support. Anything that you can do to start, just to start, whether it's with a group of young girls at creche, whether it's a group of young girls at primary school or high school to mentor them, to give them guidance, is a good place. One of my favorite things to speak about is how we are socialized as girls. Things like buying toys, like dolls and prams and cooking sets and tea sets and little Barbie houses necessarily put girls into positions of nurturing where they are expected to be domesticated from a young age. And this is how a good girl behaves and play with your doll and play with your tea set and your Barbie doll. We need to start including more gender neutral toys for our kids. And I'm talking about both girls and boys. We also need to start being careful around the sort of clothing that we're buying for girls in particular. Because if you are constantly buying them dresses with buttons at the back and zips at the back, you're making them dependent on someone else for something as simple as dressing themselves. And you look at boys' clothes, all the boys' clothes have got zips and buttons in front. So they are learning independence literally from the age of 2 or 3 when they learn to dress themselves. But a little girl always has to ask someone to tie up the ribbon on the back of her dress, to help her with the buttons on the back, and she can't reach the zip. And that's creating a sense of dependency. And it's making her feel inadequate and less than for something that she should have full agency on, choosing your own clothes and dressing yourself. Let's be careful, even right down to the clothes that we are buying for girls. And I'm begging everyone out there, single moms, single dads, parents, married couples, please, please buy your girls clothing with zips and buttons front. It's like a silly thing to say, but it's a very easy way to change how the kids are socialized. And to understand that a lot of the socialization takes place within the home environment. So, what is role models for the kids? The toys that are bought for the kids changes a lot in terms of how they see themselves and how they interact. And to appreciate a lot of socialization also takes place at the schools. So, we can't divorce the schools and the home environment for how girls are socialized and brought up. But my main thing, Ilham, really is just the toys and the clothing for girls. And I think I've made my point around that.
Okay, so when it comes to healthcare and education, Rafael, where there's many barriers for young women, Not only because of the stigma surrounding a lot of cases in South Africa, but beyond geographical distance and financial constraints, because not many people can afford medical aid. So we rely on government institutions, which is the hospitals and normal hospitals. What are the subtle yet significant social and cultural barriers that continue to impede equitable access to quality healthcare, especially when it comes to reproductive healthcare? To have access to like the pill and the injection and condoms, and education for women and girls in marginalizing rural communities in South Africa, because you get a female condom, but I mean, nobody really, not many people have seen a female condom, to be honest. So like, and I also feel like in our cultures, it's very taboo to talk about these things because, you know, you're not supposed to have sex before marriage. But let us look at the reality of the situation. Girls and boys have sex before marriage. And to not address this issue and to not help them protect themselves is something that really irritates me because you know what is happening and but you don't want to really help. So like, how do you think we can prioritize this so that we can kind of sort it out?
So fundamentally, the girls and the boys and the young women and the young men who are involved in intimate relationships are probably getting advice from their peers, or they're getting advice from social media and Instagram, because to your point, we're not going to deny the fact that this is something that is happening. And I'm not sure what very good advice you're going to be getting from someone the same age as you and in the same position as you, or an Instagram influencer or something on social media, because a lot of the social media and stuff that's coming up now online isn't even verified to be coming from a human source. A lot of it is just generated by AI and is something that you cannot say is a trustworthy or reliable source. So, how can you be taking advice from this AI that doesn't even know you or can't even empathize with your situation? What I'm going to say is that they need to be tapping into reliable online sources. And there are a few that they can search for. There are organizations like MENA who are very, very active in terms of period poverty, ending period poverty by distributing menstrual cups, by educating girls around menstrual cups. This also taps into the issue around healthcare and sanitary wear in general, because if you are using things like pads and tampons, they need to be disposed of safely and adequately and not be in an environment where they are exposed and potentially causing more disease and harm to the people around the area. So things like the menstrual cups require very little in terms of being kept in a sanitary place when you're not using them, and also how to clean them out and keep them safe. And while you are using them and menstruating, and certainly there are certainly less environmental impacts in terms of that versus having to dispose of two or three pads a day or two or three tampons a day and having to keep yourself clean in terms of that.